This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from Tuesday, the 17th of May. We're going to start by looking at what the central bank calls a new era of growth under the new president of the UAE, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. Going to get the thoughts of Khatija Haque of Emirates NBD. Also, Serena is going to talk us through some of the events of the past 72 hours. Then we're going to turn our attention to the Lebanese economy, the thoughts of the former economy minister in Lebanon, Dr. Nasser Saidi. Talking oil with Sean Evers of Gulf Intelligence, the rising oil price, $114 a barrel and record profits for Saudi Aramco. And staying with the wider theme of commodity-based inflation, looking at the rising wheat price, it is at a record at the moment after India effectively banned exports of wheat. Marshall Gittler, who's a soft commodities expert at BD Swiss. All that to come, but first up, let's jump into the big story of the weekend. Top story, of course, this week is the president of the UAE, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. And being the Business Breakfast, we're looking at the economic legacy of His Highness Sheikh Khalifa and looking forward to the economic policies of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. Now, as pretty much every media outlet has been reporting, Brandy, I think it's fair to say it's going to be business as usual. MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, has been very influential in economic policy for Abu Dhabi and the UAE for many, many years now. And nobody is expecting any dramatic or radical shift, just a continuation, I guess, of the economic reforms.
Yes, because as you say, he has played a big role in where the country is and the way that it's been going at the moment. Some quite impressive people, though, coming to the UAE to touch base with him, offer condolences and also, you know, technically throwing their support behind where the country is going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Serena's going to give us the rundown of that in a few minutes' time, but it is a very, very impressive list of world leaders. In terms of the economics, we've been speaking to Khatija Haque, Chief Economist and Head of Research at Emirates NBD, and she's been talking to us about things like reforms, direction of growth over the past couple of years under the stewardship of His Highness Sheikh Khalifa as president, of course, and Mohammed bin Zayed as Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi.
The UAE's economy has recovered faster than expected from the pandemic, with growth estimated at around 3.8% last year. We expect growth to accelerate further in 2022 as oil production recovers sharply and non-oil sector growth remains robust. The government has also announced a series of reforms and strategies that will underpin continued growth and economic diversification over the medium term. These measures include those to boost high value-added manufacturing, increase the production of clean energy, drive growth in the fintech industries, and also ensuring greater food security. The visa reforms that have been introduced over the last couple of years, and also other measures such as the recently announced unemployment insurance scheme, will also boost the UAE's competitiveness when it comes to attracting talent and investment to the country, which is, of course, essential to drive growth going forward.
Khatija Haque of Emirates NBD. I was looking at the GDP numbers, and if you're going to give an economic scorecard on the ruler of a country, or the head of state, then I guess GDP over the period, their incumbency is the way to do it. Mm. The numbers are impressive. 2004, when Sheikh Khalifa became president, GDP in US dollars was $147 billion. This year, it's going to be about, UBS reckons, $440 billion. So the economy's basically tripled under his watch. That's not a bad result, is it? We'd all take that.
No, we'd all take that. And it's interesting, the other figures that have come out, the population one was the one that sort of caught my attention. It's basically doubled during his tenure here in the UAE. Now, that's got a lot to do with
your children.
It's got very little to do with them at the moment, but it's got a lot to do with the growth of the UAE. But that growth comes from the vision of the leaders and the policies that are put in place. By it being more and more attractive for people to come here, set up their businesses, investment to come in, bring their families here, etc. The infrastructure that's built, you know, be that schools, education, hospitals, as we mentioned a little bit earlier on. So 4.07 million in 2004, so just shy of 10 million last year in 2021, the most recent year for figures available. significant increases there in line with GDP figures you were giving there, life expectancy, healthcare, as we mentioned, education has been mentioned. And I'm assuming, I haven't seen the numbers, but FDI, foreign direct investment, must have gone up during that time as well.
Oh, it must have. I don't have the data, but it must have done. And I guess that's political stability. I mean, we know we're talking about the Lebanese elections at the moment and what's happening there, GDP falling 50%. We'll hear from Dr. Nasser Saeedi in a second. But the UAE, you know, until last week, had had two rulers in 50 years. That's the kind of stability. It doesn't matter which country you are. That's the kind of stability that fuels the kind of stuff that we look at the Business Breakfast. Economic development, business growth, business investment. You know, the Microsoft of this world, we're going to be down there at their headquarters next week. You know, they like that kind of stability, don't they? And that's why we've seen this significant investment.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, a lot of people can say, we quite often ask the question about the UAE's position on the global stage at the moment. And if ever you needed evidence of that, and just echo what Brandy's point a little earlier on as well, you look at the number of people that have come to pay their respects in person, not just sending a tweet, not just sending a message through an embassy, but the number of world leaders who have got onto a plane and come to pay their respects in person. That is evidence of the impact of the legacy of His Highness and, of course, the legacy of the UAE.
Well, Tarek has written in saying exactly the same thing. Tarek says, really impressive lineup of world leaders here this weekend. Says a lot about the UAE's status on the world stage. We're going to bring in Serena Kelly now, who's with us in the studio. Morning, Serena.
Morning, guys.
You've been looking, you've been tracking the events of the past 72 hours from Friday through to today.
That's right.
Not just the world leaders that are here, but that's part of what you've been looking at. What have you learned?
Yep. So basically, Friday afternoon, the UAE's president, His Highness Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan, passed away. The Ministry of Presidential Affairs made the announcement, declared a 40-day mourning period, which started on Friday. The national flag has been flying at half-mast and will continue to do so during this mourning period time. Work was suspended in ministries, federal and local institutions and the private sector for 3 days. That started on Saturday. You also had private schools in select emirates such as Dubai. They also shut as well. But operations have resumed today. His Highness Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan was the eldest son of Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, the founding father. He was known to be a good listener, modest and interested in his people, of course. And it was Friday evening, the late UAE president was laid to rest at Albertin Cemetery in Abu Dhabi. Funeral prayers were held in mosques across the country after the Maghrib prayer. And if you have never seen how funerals are performed here in the UAE, I recommend getting on to our socials, the Erin News Centre website, app, Instagram, because we've shared a video there and you can see the entire funeral procession from leaving the palace, what they actually do, how it's performed, and it is quite moving. But condolences have been and still are pouring in from leaders around the world. Many nations have been observing 3 days of mourning, such as Bahrain, Oman and Kuwait. US President Joe Biden said Sheikh Khalifa was a true partner and friend of the United States. We will honor his memory by continuing to strengthen the longstanding ties between the governments and people of the United States and the United Arab Emirates. You've had so many comments coming in and condolences, like the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi as well, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the list goes on. But then on Saturday, the Federal Supreme Council unanimously elected His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan as President of the United Arab Emirates, succeeding the late Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sunday, you had French President Emmanuel Macron. He arrived in the UAE. He was sharing his visit on Twitter. You've also had UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson here in the UAE to pay his respects, along with Prince William, the Duke of Cambridge. US Vice President Kamala Harris, also with her delegation, with US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, John Kerry, the US Presidential Envoy for Climate. Also had Australia's Governor General David Hurley, but you've just had so many leaders. You can check the Erin News Centre, just all these photographs, you know, leaders from Bahrain, Qatar, Pakistan, Indonesia, Spain, Israel, Kenya. It's just been the outpouring of emotion and congratulations has been really high over the weekend.
And of course, MBS here as well.
Yes.
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Very significant. We could go on. The list is extensive.
Exactly.
Serena, other stories that we're looking at today. We're getting lots of questions in about masks. A lot of people have been out in the shopping malls over the past few days and concerned, a lot of listeners, about the fact that not everyone is wearing a mask. We had one earlier in this morning from, I think it was Tim in Dubai. It was Rob who wrote in about masks. Adil has written in as well. If you were walking around the malls in Dubai, you would swear that the mask mandate was gone this weekend. I was in a mall as well, Adil, and I wouldn't go quite that far, but I take your point. Serena, the mask mandate has not gone.
No, definitely not. You still have a 3,000 dirham fine connected to it. The only change was announced by NSEMA. It came into effect February 26 of this year, saying it was no longer mandatory to wear your mask outdoors or outside. It was more optional, but it is still very much mandatory to be wearing it indoor public spaces. So your malls, very much so, you should still be wearing it. So my only suggestion would be there are still means and ways of being able to report that if you don't feel safe or secure. I check with the security of the venue that you're visiting, perhaps. Also, Dubai Police, through their app and their website, you've got the Police Eye feature, and they actually have the tab or section which you can report COVID-19 violations there. But it's very much so definitely wearing masks indoors.
And a $3,000 fine.
Yes. Yep. $3,000. 3,000 dirhams is still the fine connected to that as well.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
More details on the Aero News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We turn our attention now to the Lebanese economy. It is a pleasure, as always, to be joined in the studio by the former Economy Minister of Lebanon, Dr. Nasser Saeedi of Nasser Saeedi and Associates here in Dubai. Nasser, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So elections in Lebanon over the past 24 hours or so. Don't want to stray too much into the politics, but you've been following the results. In simple terms, what's changed, if anything, overnight in terms of Lebanon?
By and large, the political landscape is basically unchanged. You still have major blocs and a very divided parliament. There are, however, some clear signs of reform. You're going to have maybe some 15 to 20 reform-minded MPs. That's important because these are independent people. They don't belong particularly to any of the blocs. The other point, I think, which is important from a political point of view, is that Hezbollah and its allies have lost a good deal of their representation. And that means that there may be some political changes in Lebanon in the foreseeable future. The important thing I think we need to focus on is the next government that has to be formed now that you have a new parliament. And the next political step is the election of a new president by November. So you're getting into a period of political uncertainty in Lebanon. And the most important thing is whether or not that's going to lead to some economic changes and economic reforms. Lebanon has signed an agreement, a staff-level agreement with the IMF, which incorporates a large number of reforms. So the big question is, from now till year end, will those reforms come about with a new parliament and a new government?
I know we've spoken many times before. You've never had a huge amount of confidence that we could get the kind of political and economic reforms that the IMF is asking for, and indeed some other donors are asking for. Has your confidence level improved that we might get some of those reforms?
No, and it's important to understand why. The fundamental reasons why you have this meltdown in Lebanon, economic and financial and banking meltdown, is because of losses in the banking and financial sector. The IMF has estimated, and this is already 2 years ago, that the losses were in excess of $73 billion. Much of it is at the central bank. $63 billion originated at the central bank. And those resulted from so-called financial engineering operations undertaken by the central bank. I've called them a Ponzi scheme, mainly intended to protect a highly overvalued pound. And as a result of that, what you need is to restructure the central bank and its governance. You need to restructure the banking sector. But the banking sector is refusing to acknowledge the losses it has made. So, and they are the strongest lobby by far in Lebanon. So the question is, will you have a strong government in place to force a restructuring of the banking and financial sector. And unless you have that, it's difficult to see how you're going to get growth happening again. You now have effectively a cash economy in Lebanon. Inflation has been running at over 250%. GDP is down 56% since 2019. Deposits are blocked in the banks. The World Bank and everybody else has looked at the statistics. This is the biggest financial disaster in economic history that we know of, worse than Chile and Spain. And despite that, you look at the elections, participation rate was 42%, as opposed to 2018 when things were pseudo-normal, it's 48%. So despite these crises, there wasn't a response of the electorate. And this is shocking. And you tend to end with an idea that people have become so desperate that they see no possibility of change. They've given up in many ways. And yet, I have to strike an optimistic note. If I look at the electoral results, there are young people voted, particularly here in Dubai and UAE and outside Lebanon. Young people voted in droves, and they're all reform-minded. And we have, as we said, maybe some 15 to 20 new members of parliament who are reform-minded.
Did you vote this time?
Of course.
Yes, you did. And you can vote, and your vote counts.
And my vote counts, and it was in Dubai. So there is some semblance of optimism for the future. But it's going to be a long slog. It's not going to be easy. And so the main question is, are you going to get a bloc in parliament that then elects a new government willing to undertake the deep reforms that we need, starting with a restructuring of the banking financial sector?
What, if anything, can we here in the wider region do, particularly the relatively affluent GCC states? I mean, for example, tourism, something as simple as that, yes, used to be a key pillar of Lebanon's, yes, foreign currency reserves. You know, Saudis going there for the summer. Hasn't happened for a while now. Should we start booking holidays to Beirut?
Oh, I think holidays in Beirut is certainly, and tourism is certainly on the map. Infrastructure has been severely affected over the past decade. It has not been maintained. But the most important thing, I think, is that if you do have an agreement with the IMF and starts getting implemented, what that will do is it will attract a lot of international finance into Lebanon. Already a large number of countries, including the GCC, the Europeans, and others, have promised over $11 billion. With some $4 billion coming from the IMF under an IMF program, then over the next 3 years, you have the possibility of reviving the economy, including tourism.
What about the role that China might play in terms of energy? We're short on time now, but that could be significant because energy is a big deal, isn't it?
Energy is a big deal. Renewable energy in Lebanon, particularly solar, wind, water, are all possibilities for Lebanon, and you certainly need that. That's part of the reforms. Remember, the electricity sector in Lebanon has been costing us something like $1.5 billion each year for 2 hours of electricity. That tells you the amount of corruption, waste, and bribery that exists there and that you need to overcome.
So final thoughts on what happens next this year. 30 seconds.
New parliament, some new voices requesting reforms, a new government of independence, hopefully. Otherwise, I think if that doesn't happen, I'm sorry, you're looking at a failed state on the Mediterranean.
Dr. Nasser Saeedi, as always, it's great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. It's a busy time for you, so thank you very much indeed for making time to us. That is Dr. Nasser Saeedi, former Economy Minister of Lebanon, and now the President of Nasser Saeedi and Associates here in Dubai and the UAE.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Looking at one of the big stories of this weekend, and that is Saudi Aramco posting record profits on the back of rising oil prices. We are joined now by Sean Evers, founder and managing partner of Gulf Intelligence. Sean, lovely to see you in the actual studio.
Yes, lovely to see you and see all of you here at the same time. Nobody's actually on holidays off somewhere, that 3 weeks that Goldman Sachs are giving. That's half of what you guys get, isn't it?
So
Who invited him?
I know, right? You ruin it for everybody. So Saudi Aramco, Looking at an 82% rise in profits, the stock up around 30% so far this year. Is it simplistic to run with the headlines that many are, which is oil giant sees profits rise on rising oil prices?
No, it's not simplistic. It's a pretty simple business in that regard. Obviously, the higher the oil price, the more the revenue. What pretty much stays consistent over the years and the decades, more or less, is the amount of production remains the same. But what you sell it at does change. But unlike many other products, I suppose, you know, you're selling a can of Coke, that typically over 10, 20 years just keeps going up, 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 up and up. Whereas oil does a bit of an up and down thing all the time. And now we're clearly in an up phase. So the more you produce of it, the higher the price, the more revenue you're going to get. Of course, profit is determined by, you know, costs minus, you know, revenue minus costs. And you want to keep your costs down and run a very efficient business in order to maximize profit. And Aramco is the best, one of the best in the world at that. And of course, they have very low cost of production, i.e. the price that they have to put in order to get oil out of the ground is lower than anywhere else. So their potential for margin is much greater than anywhere else. But ultimately, the higher the price, the bigger the revenue. The question now is, what do they do with all the money?
They give it back to the shareholders, or at least $19 billion of it. Tell me what this does mean for shareholders in bonus shares and dividends.
Well, it's a massive time. Anybody with half a brain, not like me, would have gone into oil a year ago when it was going into negative territory. The price of oil dropped, if you might famously remember, to minus $40 in the US during the pandemic. But ultimately, during the pandemic, the oil companies globally now, all publicly traded companies and even non, didn't make very much money. And in essence, they even lost money. And so the shareholders, for the first time in probably decades in terms of the international oil companies, were some of them were not paid a dividend, which is ultimately sort of sacrosanct in that space. They held on and now they're getting a bumper bargain. The interesting thing and the challenging thing for all of us and for the industry as a whole is that much more money is going back to shareholders, is going into share buybacks, and not very much is going into new capacity, which ultimately is going to sustain the continued stress and tightness in the oil market, because we have had somewhat reduced investment in new oil and gas exploration and production capacity for now 5, 6 years, 7 years. And each year that goes by and there's little money invested, that ultimately means tightness, and a projection for higher prices.
You say it's not being invested, but the investment into oil technology and new capacity was actually quite a big part of these earnings. I mean, Aramco is on a path to increase its oil production by more than 1 million barrels a day in the next 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, exception being the national oil companies. I suppose I still don't categorize Aramco as a publicly traded company, although technically it is, and technically it's the most valued company in the world by market valuation. But ultimately, it's still 95% owned by the government of Saudi. So, you know, you call it what you want. But they are investing for obvious reasons that they have very, very low cost production. I think more importantly, the story is globally, because, as you say, Aramco is not alone. All of the major oil companies in Q1 made an absolute fortune, and all of them are more or less giving most of it back to shareholders and investing a minimal amount into new production capacity. You know, you've the United States, for example, this year, the world's largest oil producer, it has to be said, only adding less than 1 million barrels of oil, given that they are still way below their pre-COVID levels. Their investment into new capacity is let's just say muted at best, and that's there's $100 oil to be had for every barrel you produce, and yet they're not, because the sort of strange reality is the more you produce, the lower the price goes. Why would you produce any more?
Well, are governments going to take that, though? Again, not so much from Aramco, as you say, but from some of the private oil companies. The rhetoric for the last couple of years is that one of the reasons we had the European gas crisis was not enough investment in infrastructure when prices were too low to make it attractive, and or governments were more interested in greener, more votable energy infrastructure projects. Now you've got the money, as you say, to invest in these things. You've got calls in places like the UK for windfall taxes on energy companies as prices rise and consumers get upset and there's pressure on politicians to bring them down. Will these companies get away with not investing?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, they're private companies operating within the law. You know, Coca-Cola is not obliged to make more Coke and ExxonMobil is not obliged to make more oil. I think the big change in the last decade that still the industry is figuring out is the shale revolution in the United States, which in the early part of the last decade essentially transformed the time frame of oil production. It became a short cycle idea. Prior to the shale revolution of 2011, 12, 13, oil exploration and production was kind of like a 10 to 20 year cycle. You invested huge amounts of money. You dug a few wells. And in this neighborhood, you don't dig too many wells because the fields are massive. But in the shale revolution, it became you could do all of that in 12, 24 months. The short cycle of investment around new oil production in the US and particularly in the shale patch changed the psychology and the investment cycle for. And there's still that attitude that in the US, we can manufacture rather than produce more oil when it's absolutely necessary. And as long as OPEC Plus and Saudi Arabia, principally UAE and a few others, and we're getting pretty close to that point, as long as they have idle capacity, US producers are not going to add to their production capacity, because at any point, Saudi Arabia, UAE could add from their capacity. So until Saudi and UAE max out, you can expect the US to be rather sober in their investment in new capacity.
15 seconds left. We've got more demand potentially coming from China, but maybe less energy from Russia if the EU reaches agreement. Where do you think prices are going, Sean?
Well, it's hard to see why they're going to break out of their current range of $100 Brent to $110 Brent. There might be, you know, a cataclysmic moment. We've certainly had many of those in recent years. We could have another one. There's some, you know, the Russia invasion of Ukraine still has to play out. And so far, that's had a relatively muted impact on exports. Some moment could happen where something dramatic triggers there and prices could explode to the upside.
Give me a guess.
I think they stay in this range. I get the sense that Ukraine is grinding into some kind of, you know, no real change, but horrible.
And Sean Evers, founder and managing partner of Gulf Intelligence.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
India this weekend has banned most wheat exports in a bit of a U-turn, and it has pushed prices up. Very pleased to be joined now by Marshall Gittler, who is head of investment research and a soft commodities expert at BD Swiss. Marshall, it's lovely to speak to you again. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Tell me, give us some context. Why is India doing this?
Well, because they've had a drought there, and that's really decimated the wheat harvest there, and they just want to protect their domestic supplies. You know, people outside of India don't vote in Indian elections, so the government's main responsibility is to protect its own people, and that's what they're going to be judged at. So it may be cause hardship elsewhere in the world, but those people don't vote in their elections. They want to make sure that they have enough domestic supplies.
A little bit of a U-turn, though, from India. We did have some comments from Mr. Modi earlier saying that India was ready to feed the world.
Yes, they were planning on exporting 10 million tons of wheat this year, which is amazing. They're the second largest wheat producer in the world, but they haven't been a major exporter. I think they just saw an opportunity and were planning on jumping on it. You know, Russia and Ukraine together export about 33 million tons of wheat. They would have made up about a third of it, which would have been a great contribution to the world. But because of their domestic problems, they've just decided that they can't afford to do it. And that's a huge shock. It's not a change from the past. In the past, they haven't been a big exporter, but it's a shock to what everybody was hoping for.
So let's talk about where we are now then with supply and with prices. We already had a little bit of a wheat crisis with the Ukraine war. What does India's announcement add to that?
Well, it's just another sign of nationalistic policies towards food supplies. You know, for example, I think it was Indonesia banned exports of palm oil. I think we're going to see as food prices rise globally and as shortages occur, I think we're going to see more and more of this as countries try and protect their own domestic supplies for obvious reasons. And that's just going to increase the volatility of global prices. Removes a buffer from the world supply, and therefore is going to increase volatility. It's going to cause greater cause prices to rise globally. I think it's very bad globally. It's not a very good. It's an understandable but not a good reaction. It's individuals taking action that disrupts everything for the whole. They're acting in their own self-interest.
Prices have jumped about 6% on the back of this news. How high could they go?
There's no limit. I mean, the estimates are that this, because of the problems in Ukraine and Russia, 8 to 13 million more people are going to find it difficult to get enough food. I mean, demand for food is not elastic. You know, people have to eat or they die. So prices, there's really no limit to where prices can go until you start to get demand destruction, until people just simply can't afford it anymore.
Most of us are not trading wheat futures or indeed buying bushels. What are people going to see in their lives on a daily basis?
Well, you see the price of bread rising, you see the price of noodles rising, you see the price of all and then there's a knock-on effect. Okay, people can't afford wheat, so maybe they buy something with corn. Well, the corn is also used to feed animals, so then the price of meat starts rising. It spreads throughout the agricultural complex, and that's going to be very difficult, especially for poorer people who spend a greater percentage of their money on food. It's going to be very difficult.
Which means it could hit.
No, there are some countries like Eritrea sources all of its wheat from Ukraine and Russia. What is this country going to do? Where is it going to get food? And it's going to be a cause of big hardship for many countries.
What does your inflation outlook look like at the moment at BD Swiss Marshall?
Well, it looks to me like global inflation is starting to at least peak. And slowly turn down. We're seeing in some countries that the consumer price index has peaked and is coming down, but it's going to be very slow. What we're seeing is that originally inflation was, price hikes were localized in areas that had been hit by the pandemic, like used cars, airfares, hotels, and things like that. Now we're seeing it spread out to other areas, other components as well, such as rents.
Before we let you go, can you put some numbers on your inflation outlook for us and also how that fits into what we are likely to see in terms of stagflation or even a recession? We got some quite sobering comments from Jed Powell this weekend about the fact that the Fed's measures to try and contain it would bring pain.
Yes. You know, the whole purpose of raising interest rates is to reduce demand. It's to cause unemployment to go up and to get people to buy less. It's to inflict pain, demand destruction. That's the only way. If you can't bring supply up, you have to bring demand down. I would hope to see, say, U.S. inflation down to 5% by the end of the year, but still their goal is 2%, and that's 5% would still be more than double their goal. I think they're going to have to raise interest rates higher than the market expects. And I think there's going to be a recession in the U.S. and probably globally.
Well, on that cheerful note, Marshall Gittler, head of investment research and soft commodities expert at BD Swiss, speaking to us this morning, I believe from Cyprus. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Yeah, this debate has been playing out, hasn't it, about the recession over the weekend.
Look, it has indeed. I mean, let's just have a look at those comments that we did get from Jay Powell. Steady Fetty, as the CNN night crew have christened him. A couple of really interesting points that he made. First off, he has pretty much admitted to CNBC that delaying the response to inflation, delaying those interest rate rises, may have been a mistake. Sorry, that's former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke saying it may have been a mistake. Meanwhile, current Fed Chair Jay Powell basically said there's not a lot of guarantee that what they're doing will bring about the desired effect, but that it would be, as I said, painful.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.